It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kend. Many Americans are sleep deprived. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, roughly one in three people don't get enough Z's. And once we are able to drift off, what is happening in sleep cycles, especially REM, rapid eye movement, and twitching? Call in with a question or comment as we discuss the science of sleep, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mark Blumberg is a professor and the chair of the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at University of Iowa. Mark, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Good morning. You've been studying sleep now for decades. What attracted you to the science of sleep?
Actually, it was just a course that I took in graduate school at the University of Chicago with one of the pioneers of sleep research, a guy by the name of Alan Rechtschaffen. And although it took me a decade or more to finally get into studying sleep, that sort of planted the seed that was sitting there. And I eventually, made my way through it. I made it through by studying development. And I was studying other aspects of development in baby rats, temperature regulation and vocalizations and maternal behavior and things like that. And then I started to notice certain things about sleep in baby rats, and that hooked me and eventually sort of moved my entire research program in the direction of sleep.
In this vast research area of sleep, are there still breathtaking developments? Is there still a lot to be learned?
Oh, there's more to be learned than not. I mean, it's we're still in the baby era of understanding sleep. I mean, it really took off the sleep field in the 1950s, 60s or so. That's when things happened. It's even accelerated in the last 20 years in an enormous way. But we still have a long way to go in terms of understanding basic issues about sleep.
Wow. And your research focuses on what's called REM sleep. Give us a primer here. What is REM sleep?
Well, sleep generally in mammals and birds, let's focus on them for now, they fall into two categories of sleep, two broad categories. One is called REM, or rapid eye movement sleep. It's got a number of other names. It's called active sleep. It's been called inappropriately dream sleep. It's called a paradoxical sleep. So it's basically an aspect of sleep that is characterized by a lot of activity. That's one reason why it was called paradoxical sleep, because you're asleep on the one hand, but you're doing a lot of stuff on the other. And that stuff includes, an activated brain that looks more wake-like than sleep-like. And also there are a lot of movements, the rapid eye movements that gave it its name, the twitches that occur, irregular breathing. There's just a lot going on. And the second form of sleep is called non-REM. Sorry.
I was going to say, that doesn't sound very restful.
It is. Well, it's, rest is, we often think of rest as doing nothing, but but there are things that have to go on while we're sleeping, as it turns out, that are important for just being able to do what we need to do.
You also said REM sleep, inappropriately called dream sleep. Why is that?
Well, because we dream in all aspects of sleep. The dreams can be somewhat different in quality, but and I'm no dream expert. That's not been the focus of my work, but we dream, we have dreams throughout the night in both stages, both primary stages of sleep. It's just that the dreams that occur in REM sleep are the real bizarre ones, as it turns out. So it's, they're more of the hallucinatory types of dreams that people think of, I think. Lots of strange things happening in them.
Why might that be?
We don't know. one of the dominant theories is that the activity that's happening mostly in the brainstem, massive amounts of activity that's sending information up to the brain, to the cortex. And the cortex is sitting there receiving all of this seemingly random information or random activity, and is trying to make sense of it. And so it could have something to do with just the heightened activity of sleep and the cerebral cortex's, I'll say it's desire in quotes to try to make sense of it, that gives those sorts of dreams their hallucinatory quality.
We're talking about the science of sleep with University of Iowa Professor Mark Blumberg as our guide. And you can join in with your questions and comments. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Mark, REM, part of a cycle. What other kinds of sleep are there?
Well, there's the other part that's appropriately called non-REM, also has a variety of other names. It's called quiet sleep. It's called synchronized sleep and delta sleep. It's got a, you know, one of the problems with the field is we have a lot of names for the same things, reflecting somewhat our ignorance about what's going on. But the non-REM form of sleep is where we're mostly relatively still. Our breathing is very regular. There are these dominant waves of activity in the cortex and other parts of the brain that are slow oscillations of brain activity. So not that jumble of activity that we see during REM sleep. And so it's a very, very different set of factors, of components that are going on in that stage of sleep.
Is there evidence that one type of sleep is more important than others in the cycle?
Yeah, no, I don't think we should go there. I think it's, I mean, I think that there are sleep researchers who prefer to study one stage of sleep over another. But I think they're both extremely important. They're both highly conserved across species. They seem to be more complementary than antagonistic. So probably it has something to do with one of them doing something that the other one picks up on and completes or restarts or cycles back on. So it's, like I said, one of the biggest mysteries, one of many mysteries about sleep, is how REM and non-REM sleep complement each other across the sleep cycle.
As you then view the barrage of sleep cycle terminology, what distinguishes REM sleep from deep REM sleep?
Well, the word deep is used often in a lot of confusing ways. It's sometimes used for the non-REM part of sleep to indicate that it's harder to wake somebody up from that phase of sleep. But so it's not a word I use a lot because I find it to be very, I've always found it to be very confusing when applied to sleep like this.
Okay.
So I mean, I think, you know, REM sleep, it's very hard to wake up from, except for the fact that that's the stage of sleep that we normally wake up from in the morning, assuming we don't have an alarm clock. So when you're waking up in the morning, you're waking up typically out of REM sleep. So that's one aspect of it. But while you're in REM sleep, it can be very hard to wake you up. In fact, sometimes dreams will work their magic to sort of cover up things that are going on in the outside world. Like an alarm clock may go off, but you will incorporate that alarm clock into your dream, thus protecting your sleep, at least for a few more minutes.
Looking to infants now, infants spending about 16 hours a day sleeping, as much as half of that time is REM sleep. Why do babies need to sleep so much?
Well, that's the motivating mystery of my adult life, I guess, is trying to understand that. So, you know, 99% of research in sleep is focused on adult sleep. And yet the dominant, you know, states in newborns is sleep. I mean, we sleep more when we're young than any other time of our lives. And so that's, to me, a real reason to focus on sleep in early infancy because it's just happening so much. And so if you want to understand how sleep functions and how it comes together and how the parts work together, I think studying how it emerges over development is a really good way to go. And so that's why I've focused a lot of my research there because it's proven to be, you know, a goldmine of information in terms of understanding basic things about sleep. So it's just a weird quirk, you know, of how science can sometimes go where people focus on the things that where things are happening actually less often. But the mystery really is that, yes, we are sleeping 16 hours a day as babies, newborns. It's even more than that in utero. So it can be up to upwards of 80%, somewhere between 70 and 90% of the time we're asleep in the womb. And that's typical across all mammals, birds, and even many other types of animals. So it appears to be a universal feature that we sleep most when we're young. And many years ago in the 1960s, it was suggested that that connection between sleeping a lot when you're young and the idea was that you sleep a lot when you're young. So what does that tell you? And what else is going on when we're young? Well, obviously we're developing, we're growing, we're incorporating our body into our brain. We're figuring out how our body works. We're constantly adapting to our changing body. You know, as the limbs are growing and our weight is changing, we're getting taller. We're learning how to behave. We're learning in lots of things. And so it was suggested that maybe sleep plays a role in that developmental process. And so that's been something that I've been focusing a lot on, and as have a few other people on this problem.
Professor Mark Blumberg studies sleep and behavioral development at the University of Iowa. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Scientists uncover different ways that the brain is activated during sleep, especially during the REM sleep stage with the rapid eye movements and the little twitches and jerks of the body. We explore the latest science on brain activity during sleep, and you can call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have University of Iowa Professor Mark Blumberg, who is a behavioral neuroscientist. Mark, REM sleep often associated with dreams. I know you don't study dreams per se, but are dreams a reason for REM sleep or simply a byproduct?
Well, that's been those are the two competing ideas that have existed for millennia, really. So, you know, it's very hard to answer that question because it's hard to gain direct access to what people are dreaming. But here's where I think things have gone, where the concept of dreams got in our way. So take the twitches that you've referred to that occurred during REM sleep. These are fine movements. They're very unique movements. And they have been, you know, classically or, you know, referred to as, you know, like a dog chasing its dreams or something like chasing rabbits or something like that. And that idea goes back to Aristotle. And so if you think about that, if you think about dreams as causing those movements, then you think, okay, well, what could explain it? Why are they just incomplete movements? Why are they twitches? And so the idea was that during REM sleep, you are functionally paralyzed. Your brain is actually inhibiting the movements of your limbs, except during these very brief periods when the twitches are allowed. And so what you might think is, okay, well, maybe you're dreaming about something very complex, but this paralysis system, this muscle atonia, as it's called, prevents you from acting out your dreams. And so what happens is that the twitches are just like these little shadows of those dreams sort of squeaking through, leaking through the system and showing themselves at these fine little jerks. So that's one way to think about it. It's a dream outward movement kind of an explanation. But there's another possibility, and the one that I think is actually correct, which is that instead of having, if you think about the dreams happening in the cortex, so everything's flowing down from the cortex through the brainstem, through the muscles, and that's what's producing the movements. But the reversal of that idea is this, that the brainstem, which we know is where the twitches are actually produced, is producing those movements for a purpose. Hmm. And then what's happening is that you're generating those movements and you have sensory feedback coming from those movements, from the stretch receptors in your muscles. It can be from the touch, you know, the sensitive parts of your skin to touch if you happen to touch an object. And so you get this feedback coming in, and now that's what's causing the flow of information up to the brain. And that is what's causing sometimes shaping the types of dreams that we have. So those are two very different ideas. And the thing is that we actually have strong proof-like evidence that the latter story is the correct one, that the brainstem produces the movements. The movements have sensory feedback consequences, which then flow into the brain. I've recorded this activity throughout the brain of baby animals. And you see just how light lit up the brain is in relationship to twitches, not from the cortex down. Moreover, at the ages that I'm studying are, you know, the sleep in our animals, the cortex can't produce movements. It's actually not functionally capable of producing movements. It's true for human infants, probably through around at least four to six months after age, after birth. And so we know that the cortex couldn't even produce the dream like twitches if they wanted to. So it's this reversal of the causal relationship, which I think is fascinating from a conceptual perspective, but also happens to be super important just from an understanding how the system works perspective. And so then the question might be, you know, well, what do twitches do? What makes them special?
And is there a more quantity of REM sleep in the infants and babies you study?
Yeah. So that's when it's happening the most. I mean, probably somewhere around 50% of the time is spent twitching in a newborn rat. We see similar things. We also, in my lab, we also study human infants. We study them at birth. We study them at full-term infants. We study premature infants in the neonatal intensive care unit at the University of Iowa Children's Hospital. And so we see just an enormous amount of twitches, as we suspected we would based on what we know in other animals.
And you have very, very young research subjects who can't mm-hmm. clearly communicate. Is that a challenge in your research?
No, it's a relief. It simplifies the problem, right? Because you're no longer, if you're studying dream activity, then you ask somebody after they wake up what they were dreaming about. And it's all very, it's hard to really have confidence sometimes in what you're being told. But it's for us, it challenges us when you can't rely on verbal reports. It challenges us to come up with really good, solid methods for figuring out what's going on inside the brain and the body during sleep.
We're talking about the science of sleep with University of Iowa Professor Mark Blumberg. You can join in with your questions and comments. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Martha in Port Washington with a question. Hi, Martha.
Hi, good morning.
What would you like to bring up?
My father has a progressive supranuclear palsy, a fairly rare brain disease, and he sleeps now pretty much any time he's not being woken up for a meal or to go to the restroom. So I'm wondering what the purpose of sleep is in that, or the function of sleep is in that disease process.
Martha, thank you for that question. Mark, go ahead.
Well, I'm not an expert in that particular disorder. I'm not a clinician, I should say. But sometimes there are conditions in which sleep becomes the predominant state. And that could be looked at, I suppose, as sleep doing something functional, but it could also be due to a failure of the arousal system. So, you have these two competing systems where you have sleep pushing for its dominance against an arousal system that keeps us awake. And in a way, you can think about you could also think about that as what's happening in early development too, that we sleep a lot because the arousal system hasn't developed sufficiently. But I think as we get older and we start to have problems like these, certain types of diseases or disorders, you're going to have sometimes problems of the arousal system. So what really matters in terms of understanding what's going on in sleep is to have sleep tests, actually sleep measurements to know what kinds of sleep are happening. Is it normal sleep? Or is it, something else? So that's, and I'm sure that's happened in this case, but that's all I can say about this condition.
When you talk about the arousal system, Carol in Milwaukee wants to know what debilitating effect does being awakened four times a night have on a person?
Yeah, so there are a variety of sorts of problems that arise when you have disrupted sleep. And it shows itself in a variety of different ways. I think you at the top of this of the hour, you mentioned how many people in the United States are not getting enough sleep. Now, how much sleep you get is a very subjective thing. And anybody who tells you should get 7.5 hours or any number is just wrong. There is no definitive number that's true for any given individual. I mean, across, based upon averages, what really matters is whether or not you wake up in the morning feeling refreshed. I mean, that's ultimately, it's up to you to decide how much sleep you need. But the problem is that, we have all of these things that happen in our lives that prevent us from getting good sleep. Either we stay awake too long and can't fall asleep, or we wake up throughout the night. And that waking up throughout the night can happen for a variety of reasons. It could be because you have to go to the bathroom a lot. It could be because you have a deficit in the neural system that keeps you asleep. So there are just a whole host of things that happen. And as we age, one of the things that happens among many is that we have more and more troubles regulating our body temperature. And it turns out that REM sleep will not happen if you are too cold or too hot. Huh. And so if you're losing your ability to regulate your temperature and you don't have a comfortable environment to sleep in, like either you don't have, good heating system or cooling system, depending on the season, then you will not have the right amount of REM sleep. And so there's just a host of ways in which sleep can be disrupted, as we should expect from something as complex as this is.
It seems to be a very sensitive cycle that you're studying.
Yes, yeah. It is very sensitive. Yeah, very ancient, very well regulated. But, you know, there is some evidence that across the lifespan, there are a few, you know, there are parts of the brain that have relatively few neurons, on the order of thousands, not millions. And those neurons die across our lifetime. And when they get to a certain point, when too many have died, that's when you start to see problems like insomnia.
Professor Mark Blumberg studies sleep as chair of University of Iowa's Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences. You can join the conversation about sleep at any point. Call in with a question. Add your views. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Sleep happens in stages. We explore REM sleep. Eric in Roseville, Minnesota believes that sleep helps their aging father's body to recover and repair with the medicine he's taking. You can email with your question, your thoughts, 800 or ideas at WPR.org. Mark Blumberg here, professor and chair of the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at University of Iowa. Let's bring in Tom in Green Bay. Tom, hi.
I have a question regarding SSRIs and their role on the sleep cycle. About 7 years ago, I started taking Lexapro, which, you know, helped with my anxiety, but it messed up my sleep cycle to where I would have trouble falling asleep and would wake up every 90 minutes, which I'm assuming was at the end of my sleep cycle. I take mirtazapine to help me sleep. It's like a light sedative and another anxiolytic. And that helps me stay asleep throughout the night. So I know you're not a doctor, but I would like to, you know, get an idea of what serotonin's role is on the sleep cycle and why some sedatives may also positively or negatively impact that. So.
Tom, thanks for the question. Well, Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a conundrum that faces anybody who takes drugs that affect these sorts of systems. So, you know, your listener's correct. SSRIs, they influence the serotonin system. There are other systems like serotonin. They're all called neuromodulators. Other examples are things like dopamine that many people know about, norepinephrine, which many people know about. And all of these, what's really interesting about these neuromodulatory systems is that they are all involved in sleep regulation. So if you record from the brain areas that produce these neuromodulators, you will see that they are variously affected by sleep or many times contributing to sleep. So, for example, the serotonin system is highly active during wake and they turn off during sleep. Same thing is true for the norepinephrine system. And there are other ones that are the opposite, that are active during wake and during sleep and then turn off during wake. And so it should be no surprise then that when you take a drug that influences these systems, that there are going to be side effects that are going to influence your ability to sleep. That's the problem with pharmacology, you know, with taking drugs, is that you can't target things just for the problem that you're trying to address, because these systems are affecting lots and lots of different things: learning, memory, arousal, you know, attention. And so because of that, and physiology, and so because of that, you're going to have these sorts of problems. It's just until we have more targeted drugs, if such drugs will exist, that we're going to have these problems that creep over into the sleep-wake cycle.
Tom, thank you for that question. Kathleen now in Sun Prairie. Kathleen, hi, go ahead. Hi, Kathleen, can you hear us? Okay, Kathleen, I'm sorry, we can't hear you at the moment, but Kathleen is wondering, Mark, what about people whose sleep cycle is reversed? That you sleep during the day instead of during the night, what happens in the brain cycle?
Well, the sleep, you have this reversal of the circadian phase is basically what is being referred to here. It happens in a small number of people. And you know, your sleep can be quite normal, such as it is in that reversal state. But what's failed is that you don't have a system that's regulated typically for your species. Now, of course, there are species that are nocturnal. Rats are nocturnal. They're awake at night, or more awake at night than during the day. And so, you know, we're a diurnal species. We also tend to sleep in huge chunks of periods, 8 hours typically. And that's not always the same for other animals either. But the key is that, you know, when you're the part of your system that regulates your circadian system, your 24-hour day-night cycle, it can develop abnormally, and you end up with the circadian phase problem. It's funny, the person who wrote an article about my work and others in the New Yorker in the end of August, she has a sleep circadian phase issue. So she's awake at night and she sleeps during the day. And she wrote a piece in the Modern Love series in the New York Times. It was actually made into one of their short little things about her trying to find love as a you know, with a person who has a normal sleep phase cycle. So it happens, and people learn how to adjust to it, but it can be very, very difficult given the way our society is set up.
In the presentations you make, you've referenced a circus performer, Johnny Eck, who starred in the 1932 movie Freaks, and his legs never developed and learned to walk on his hands. How does that story relate to your research with sleep?
Yeah, well, it's one of these weird things. So I wrote a book about it, called Freaks of Nature. It came out some years ago, and it was about all the different ways that development can happen. And Johnny Eck was a circus performer, and he was an actor, and he was in a movie called Freaks, directed by Todd Browning, which came out in 1932, which I highly recommend. A rather bizarre movie. But what Johnny Eck was special, but not special for people with his condition. So he had an issue called amelia, which is a failure of limbs to grow. In this case, it was his two legs. But people also have similar problems with their arms. And it's not only true in humans, it happens in other animals. And I have a whole host of videos demonstrating that animals with these developmental anomalies do remarkably well if left to their own devices. So there was, you know, the medical profession would often try to intervene and try to create solutions, quote unquote, to their dilemmas, but they're best left to themselves. People without arms, they learn how to walk on their, without legs, they learn how to walk on their arms, and they're extremely agile and athletic, and they get along just fine. And people who are born without arms, they learn how to use their feet and legs in all kinds of ways that we cannot. They can type with their toes, they can... I have a video of a man who smokes with his toes and lights a Bic lighter with his other foot. I have a video of a dog without two hind legs who's running on a beach on his forepaws beautifully, just beautifully. If you wouldn't know there was anything wrong with his dog until you see that there are no legs there. So how does it all connect? This is a phenomenon known as developmental plasticity, which refers to the extreme amount of ability of a developing system to organize with the body it has, not necessarily with the body it was supposed to have. Supposed meaning from a perfect species specific sort of a perspective, which is clearly wrong. And so when you have, so the question is, how do you develop your limbs in this atypical way? So if we were to say like, well, how do I function, or how do you function with, you know, whatever, arms and legs, and you'd say, well, it could be genetically hardwired. That's a very simple, facile kind of an explanation that you hear a lot about. You just say, oh, the genes do it, or it's just, it's an instinct, or all of these things that people say that drives me kind of bonkers. So so the problem with any genetic hardwiring, of course, is you can't hardwire all of the things that you can't anticipate about development. You don't know how fast you're going to grow. You don't know what you're going to eat. You don't know what kinds of food you're going to have, and therefore how much muscle you're going to develop. And how much muscle you have is going to determine how you use your limbs. So you need to be plastic. You need to adapt in real time to the body that you have, whether it's just that, you know, arms that are getting overdeveloped or absence of limbs entirely. And so that's where I believe twitches come in, because twitches are ideally suited because of the way they're produced, how they're produced, and the influence that they have on the brain activity. They are in an ideal position to tell the brain and the entire nervous system what kinds of limbs you have, how many joints you have, how many muscles, how are they operating with each other, how are they producing the movements, and then actually using all of the activity that you see during twitching to produce the types of movements that allow your brain to compute all the possible things that your limbs can do. That's the challenge of that's the sensory motor challenge of development. And that's what I believe sleep. That's one of the reasons why I believe sleep is so prevalent when we're young.
Wow. We're exploring sleep science with University of Iowa Professor Mark Blumberg, neuroscientist, our guide. You can join in. Questions and comments, they're welcome. 800-642-1234. Jamie in Algoma is next. Jamie, hi. What would you like to ask?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am going to be working this Thursday, a morning shift. I'm usually evenings, and I had to do it yesterday to train, where I have to be at work at 7 in the morning. Now, working second shift, my body just sleeps until it naturally wakes up, which I love. But if I have to set an alarm, without fail, my body wakes up at 3 o'clock, and that's it. I'm awake. I feel like a shot of adrenaline hits and I do not go back to sleep. I can force myself to stay awake, but boy, is it really hard to force yourself to go to sleep. Any hints?
Any advice there on trying to stay with that rhythm and stay asleep, Mark?
Yeah, no, I face that problem. I think everybody has these, you know, the anxiety of waking up early and the use of the alarm clock. I mean, the problem with alarm clocks, and the reason why I'm really happy to have a job where I don't need to rely on them, is that alarm clocks are going to wake you up randomly with respect to what state you happen to be in when the alarm goes off. Now, the ideal way to wake up is naturally out of a REM sleep episode, and you have more REM sleep in the morning than you do early in the evening when you go to sleep. So that's the challenge. I believe that smart watches are getting to a place where they are timing. They can time the alarm to the stage of sleep. So if they work, and I haven't looked into the scientific validation of them, but if that's the sort of solution you want, an alarm clock that would time you to your sleep state, preferably to wake you up after a period of REM sleep.
My smartwatch has that feature. I haven't used it yet, but it is giving me that option when I do set an alarm.
Yeah.
What effect can alcohol, other substances have on sleep?
Well, I mean, alcohol is a central nervous system depressant, and so it's going to blunt many of the things that happen during sleep that are important. On the other hand, alcohol relaxes people and can reduce stress, and so can help you to fall asleep. So you end up with this double whammy where it might help at the beginning of sleep, helping you to fall asleep, but can make the quality of your sleep lesser than it should be over the night. So, you know, pick your poison.
University of Iowa Professor Mark Blumberg with us studies sleep and behavioral development, and there's space to talk about our brain and sleep. Call in with a question. Bring your discussion points. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We spend about one-third of our lives sleeping or attempting to drift off. We explore the REM sleep cycle, what could be occurring in the brain, and we discuss your questions. Call in with one, share what you wonder. The number is 800-642-1234. University of Iowa Professor Mark Blumberg is a behavioral neuroscientist researching the functions of sleep. Let's go to Quincy in Middleton now. Quincy, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Yes. What would you like to bring up?
So I have been blessed with a very healthy sleep life. And the last several years, I've been using an app called Sleep Cycle that it turns on periodically if I'm snoring or if I'm speaking in my sleep. The next morning, it's always interesting to hear what I've had to say. And one thing that I have noticed is that I can go 3 or 4 months without remembering a dream or without sleep talking. And then I'll have like a week or two of just really active sleep life where I'm talking up a storm and I remember multiple dreams in an evening. I'm wondering if you, Mark, has any theories on why that comes in cycles like that.
Quincy, thank you. Mark.
Well, I think you've discovered something very interesting. I mean, I think one thing that's going to happen, I mean, thank you for that question. I mean, I you know, this is one of the things you asked earlier in the program about, you know, how much do we know relative to what we don't. And I think this is an example. I mean, maybe there are scientists who have studied this sort of aspect. I've never seen in all the conferences and other things I've gone to hear about sleep. I've never heard about these sorts of things coming in bursts like this before. I think that's one of the advantages happening with all these wearable devices and all of these apps that are out there is that we're going to start to get maybe new insights into phenomena that we didn't know about as to what causes these sorts of bursts of unique activity during sleep. I mean, what your caller describes, it sounds fascinating to me. I just don't know of any research that's looked at it that in that way. But I think that's going to be one of the benefits. I mean, one of the challenges in the past has been, you know, to do sleep research, you'd have to bring people into your lab and they'd mm-hmm. have to sleep in a very artificial environment in the lab. And maybe you'd get them for one or two nights and maybe you'd get them, I don't know, on a random basis a month, every year, whatever, but not the kind of daily, you know, sampling that your caller is describing, where you can actually see these, because it could be extremely random or it could be, you know, very idiosyncratic to the individual as to how these cycles are organized. So, I think it's fantastic. I think we're going to learn so many interesting things.
Yes, the technology that's available to consumers could very much have scientific implications. And on mm-hmm. that front, Mark, how do you envision doctors or scientists might be able to take what you've learned in your research and help people?
Well, I mean, so we're taking it, as I said, into the neonatal intensive care unit, trying to understand the role of sleep in preemies. I mean, NICUs are not wonderful environments for sleep. And I'll give you an example. You know, in general, the care of babies in these NICUs has been guided by the doctor's schedules when they are available, when they do things, or the nurse's schedules as well. And generally, they don't pay attention to the sleep in these neonates, which is extraordinary because sleep is the most important part of their lives at these ages. So that may seem hard to imagine, you know, but it's true. And not too long ago, NICUs were brightly lit, very noisy, and it's only in recent years that NICUs have started to pay attention to these factors and the disruptions to sleep that they were causing. I have a colleague in the Netherlands now who's taking the work that I and others have done and is saying, well, we can monitor the babies in these incubators in real time, and we can have a little monitor above each incubator for every baby that says, like, they could think about it like as a stoplight or like a traffic light with a green light and a red light. Green meaning, go ahead, the baby's awake, go ahead and do what you have to do to take care of the baby. Or a red light meaning, you know, this baby's asleep, let the baby sleep, and then, you know, just give it a little bit. That is a brand new phenomenon that has never been done before. It's the only NICU that I know of in the world that's doing it. And that's the sort of change for care for premature infants that's taking place. And I would love to see that tried out in a whole bunch of other NICUs, preferably every single one, because it's just such a blind spot that neonatology has had. Another really interesting place where people have taken this work is in robotics, because, you know, robots are generally programmed to do what they do. But the question becomes, can you make a more adaptable, more flexible robot by allowing them to learn about their bodies? So imagine a robot with limbs like us, rather, and instead of simply programming the robot to use its limbs in particular ways, allow it to twitch and learn about its limbs through a more natural process. What does that mean for how robots behave? And so the work that's been done on that so far has shown that robots that learn about their body, about their limbs through twitching, are more adaptable to changes in their body, such as, say, the amputation of a robot limb, than animals that were pre-programmed that way. And so that does two things. One, it tells us, it allows us to test ideas about what sleep and twitching does, you know, in us by simulating it in a robot. But it also has the potential to create robots that will be more adaptable and smarter in the future. And so that's another interesting. So two ends of the spectrum, you know, little babies and a NICU and a robot.
What happens when those robots start having dreams?
Oh, that's, yeah, I don't know. We wake them up and they just don't say very much. But it is, you know, it's a Blade Runner.
In the preemies, how could irregular sleep or being awakened, that preemie being awakened for some type of medical intervention, how could it affect that infant's development?
Well, the possibility is that it affects it in all kinds of ways. So there are two ways to deprive somebody of sleep. I mean, you could deprive them, meaning you just do not let them go to sleep, which is, you know, used as a form of torture. But also has been done for scientific purposes to understand the role of sleep. You can also have a more what's called sleep restriction, where you're just never getting quite enough sleep and you're constantly being, you know, awakened and disrupted. You're allowed to go back to sleep, but you're just never allowed to go through full cycles or have the amount of sleep that you normally would get. And they have different effects. I mean, obviously in magnitude, but both are detrimental. And so then the question becomes, you know, as good as we have become at taking care of these premature infants, you know, really, really early and allowing them to survive, they have a lot of, they are much more prone to a variety of different problems as they grow up. And so understanding better the role of sleep and maybe mitigating some of those negative effects of prematurity by taking better care of the sleep of these babies might have a real effect on the quality of their lives.
In our last moments together here, do you anticipate scientists will be able to understand the role of dreams, or will this aspect remain a mystery?
People are getting cleverer and cleverer about studying dreams. And, you know, there are these lucid dreams that people study and things like that. There are a variety of things that people are doing, but in the end, it all comes down to whether dreams, as you put it earlier, you know, do they have a function to themselves, or are they a byproduct of the process? You know, I think that dreams reflect how our particular brains work, but whether or not they are them should be a target of our investigation, that's an open question. They may just be byproducts of an underlying system. So they may reflect important processes, but may not of themselves be important. That's one of the other mysteries, I think, that will stick around for a while.
Mark, thank you for joining us and sharing your research.
My pleasure. Good morning, Wisconsin.
Mark Blumberg is a professor and chair of the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at University of Iowa. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine a call to action, an update on a book at the dawn of the animal rights movement in the 1970s, showing today the continued suffering of animals used in testing and slaughtered for their meat. Please be aware that aspects of this conversation about animal pain could be disturbing. You can call in with a question or comments at any point, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Peter Singer is a bioethics professor at Princeton University, author of Animal Liberation Now. It is a revision of his animal rights book, first published in 1975. Peter, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So you revised the argument in your new book. Has our treatment of animals gotten better or worse in your estimation in the past 50 years?
Well, it depends where really you're talking about and which particular area of treatment of animals. In some places, it's got better. I would say the European Union has certainly improved its standards, both for the way animals can be kept in factory farming, in big intensive farms. And also, for example, they've banned the testing of cosmetics on animals and have stricter controls for animal experimentation in general. In the United States, it's more a state matter. So some states, particularly California, have on ballot initiatives also done similar kinds of things to what the European Union has done, at least for the farmed animals. But unfortunately, other states which don't have ballot initiatives, or the states that have the most farmed animals, like Iowa, Nebraska, North Carolina, they have not changed their laws at all, and there's no federal legislation to protect the welfare of animals on factory farms. So that hasn't got any better in some respects, say because chickens have been bred to grow even faster, which causes them problems with their development. Their leg bones are basically too immature to carry the weight that they put on so fast. So some things have got significantly worse.
Yeah, and so these broilers, these young chickens raised for meat, you know, they grow extremely fast and have this huge weight. Can you explain that in, you know, as a comparison to people?
Oh, well, there's, I don't remember exactly the figures, but it's something like, you know, if humans grew at the same rate, then basically a baby would weigh a couple of hundred pounds, something like that. It's an incredible rate of growth that these birds are 6 weeks old when they're slaughtered, and yet they're as large as birds that, 50 or 60 years ago would have taken twice as long or three times as long to reach that weight. And there are several welfare problems with that. As I said, their leg bones have struggled to bear their weight. One veterinary scientist who specializes in farmed animal welfare says it's like forcing somebody who has arthritis in their legs to stand up all day. Mm-hmm. And the birds do have to stand up all day, because if they sit down on the litter that they're on in the shed, there's so many bird droppings in that litter that it actually becomes a caustic substance, an alkaline substance, and it can give them burns on their skin if they sit on it too long.
If they sit on the ammonia droppings,
that's right.
Their bodies.
Yeah. It's like an ammonia burn. And there's something else about that that most people wouldn't think about. So you've bred these birds with a genetic nature so that they're going to eat all the time to put on weight as fast as possible. And for them, okay, they're at 6 weeks, they get slaughtered. So they last, most of them, not all, but most of them survive that long. But what about their parents? Their parents have to have the same genes, of course. But their parents have to live longer, because they wouldn't become sexually mature until they're more than three or four times as old as the birds that people eat. And if they were allowed to eat as much as they want to eat, they wouldn't survive that long. They would keel over from a heart attack. Or if they did survive, they'd be so fat that they wouldn't even be able to mate. So what do the producers do? Essentially, they starve the birds. Many of them only feed the birds every second day. So here are these birds bred to have a huge appetite, and every second day they have nothing. They look around for food everywhere. They can't find it. They're desperately hungry. So that's a kind of cruelty to the parents that people don't even consider.
We're talking with Peter Singer, author of Animal Liberation Now. This is an update of his 1975 pioneering book on animal rights. You can join in along the way with your question, your comments at 800-642-1234. Peter, you say animals' capacity for suffering or enjoyment gives them rights that demand consideration by humans. Why does their ability to suffer qualify them for rights?
Well, you know, it's a question of really why wouldn't we recognize that every being who can feel pain matters and has a moral status that means that their pain isn't irrelevant. It isn't just, you know, something that we can disregard as commercial producers of animals do disregard them. Pain is pain. And just as we have over the centuries, fortunately, recognized that the race or sex of a human being is not a reason for giving less weight to their interests, not a reason for saying, well, it doesn't matter whether they're living good lives or not. We recognize that those are not boundary lines that really matter morally. So we should recognize that species is also not in itself something that matters morally. I mean, I'm not saying that animals and humans are the same, but I am saying that if they're capable of feeling pain, then the importance of that pain doesn't depend on whether they're a member of one species or another. It's the capacity to feel pain that gives them the moral status that says we're not justified in ignoring that pain.
Here in Wisconsin, our license plates say America's Dairyland, and more than 1.2 million dairy cows live here. People might envision dairy cows peacefully roaming pastures and munching on grass, no worry of predators. What is the reality of life for a dairy cow?
Well, there are still some that do roam the pastures and have that freedom to do that. But increasingly, dairy farms have become more intensive, and quite a number of them, the cows don't go out on pasture. They are in stalls inside a large shed, and the food is brought to them. So essentially, they have, basically boring lives where they don't get to move around. They don't really get to socialize with other cows much. They just become milk machines. But the other thing that many people don't realize about the dairy industry is that just as with human beings, cows don't produce milk just like that. Women don't start producing milk until they've had a baby. And it's the same with cows. They don't produce milk until they've had a baby. And after a while, even if they have had a baby, the milk will dry up. So in order to produce milk for humans, dairy cows are made pregnant. They have a calf roughly every year. And the calf is, of course, taken away from them almost as soon as it's born, because the milk is for humans. Milk is not supposed to go to the calf. So that causes real distress to the dairy cows. They're mammals. They have a strong bond with their calves. I quote dairy farmers who acknowledge that if you take the calf from the cow is looking for the calf. Sometimes when cows can move around, one of them describes how whenever the cow passes the spot where her calf was taken away from her when she's being brought in and out to be milked, she stops, she looks around, she calls out, she's looking for her calf days, even weeks after the calf has been taken away. And of course, the calf, if the calf is male, the calf will be slaughtered for probably, or go into the veal industry very soon. If the calf is female, she'll be brought up to be a dairy cow herself and suffer the same fate.
And she just wants the suckling. She wants to be able to suck on something and
Absolutely. Is
looking for the mother. Princeton University bioethicist Peter Singer aims to show the vast scale of animal mistreatment. New book, Animal Liberation Now. And there's room for your voice in this discussion. Call in with a question, share your concerns. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the ethics of how we treat animals and the case for boycotting meat to try to reduce suffering, especially in industrial large-scale farms. And please be mindful that aspects of this conversation could be graphic, could be distressing. You can join in at any point with your question, your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Peter Singer's book, Animal Liberation Now, is an update on the themes of his classic pioneering book from 1975. Let's go to Mark now in Milwaukee. Mark, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
So I am the president of the Wisconsin Animal Protection Society, and we have contacted recently, it's been a couple of weeks now, the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, asking her to consider looking into discontinuing the research that UW-Madison has been doing for years on non-human primates. They use macaque monkeys, which are very social species, and yet a lot of the research involves isolation and other painful and things like injecting them with diseases. Anyway, there are non-animal research alternatives called microphysiological studies, such as organs on a chip. And we're just hoping that UW-Madison will look into that and stop using monkeys for research.
Mark, thank you for that call. Peter Singer, your insights on this research and its history.
Well, the history of research with monkeys at Madison, University of Wisconsin, is really a terrible story. It goes back to the 1960s when Harry Harlow began his work isolating baby monkeys. He was studying something that was actually already known from studies of human orphans, and that is that not having a mother around, not having contact with a mother, is a cause of depression and abnormal behavior. But Harlow in the 1960s took baby monkeys away from their mothers, kept them in total isolation for up to a year, isolation not only from other monkeys but from any contact with humans, and reported, guess what, that they are very fearful. He says that their primary reaction to any interference is fear. And then he did even worse things. Then he tried to simulate rejection by having a kind of model of a monkey covered with cloth, and when the baby monkey tried to cuddle up to this thing as the only kind of comfort that the baby monkey could get, sharp spikes or jets of air would spurt out at the monkey and push it off. It's really, and this went on for decades. In fact, one of Harlow's students, Stephen Swomey, was still doing isolation experiments on monkeys, not in Madison, but at the National Institutes of Health, in 2015, when people for the ethical treatment of animals protested, and finally NIH withdrew the funding. But you know, that's 50 years of basically harming monkeys by isolating them and depriving them of love and care and what they need. And it's really time to stop research with non-human primates altogether.
Were psychological discoveries made in doing this research? What did it gain?
No, I don't think anyone can claim that this helped us with, as I said, we already knew there was a psychologist called John Bowlby who'd done studies of human children who'd been orphans and who were in institutions. So we already knew that the care and the love and the physical contact with a mother is something that is good for children if they're to develop a normal kind of emotional life. And in terms of like a treatment or a cure for depression, nothing came out of this, you know. So we have basically 50 years of horrendous experiments causing an immense amount of suffering on monkeys. Also, of course, taking a lot of taxpayers' funds. And nobody can really point to any valuable discoveries or benefits for human beings that arose from this research.
Can you explain the scale? I mean, how many animals are experimented on at universities and research centers around the world?
Well, around the world is hard to say. I think I've seen a figure of something like 90,000 monkeys experimented on worldwide, but we don't really know. For example, China is doing research with monkeys now too. So the figures are hard to know. But, it's interesting that these monkeys are not all bred for research, that some of them are actually being captured from the wild. There is currently a senior official from the Cambodian Forestry Department who is going on trial in Miami for having forged documents which allowed wild-caught macaques to be imported into the United States. Mm-hmm. So we're also contributing essentially to endangered populations of long-tailed macaques from Cambodia.
Mark, thank you so much for the call as we talk with Peter Singer, author of Animal Liberation Now. It's an update of his 1975 book on animal rights. You can join in with your question at 800-642-1234. Eden is here from Neosho. Eden, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say I run an animal sanctuary for all types of domestic or farmed animals. And I just wanted to say, in terms of the emotional lives of animals, it's just, you know, I just see it every day. I think that most people, if they knew what was happening, like in our animal food industry, would be shocked and horrified. And I feel like it's very important that we shine a light on those things, since over 90% of all of our food, animal food, comes from confined animal operations, which are extremely cruel and just horrific. That it, you know, we have all these ag gag laws, and I feel like most people, if they actually knew what was happening in these places, would rebel against that and go for some more animal welfare or even a plant-based lifestyle.
Eden, I just want to jump in here and allow Peter Singer to respond. As you mentioned, egg gag laws. Peter, go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Eden. Clearly, you know, this is a country that believes in transparency and believes in freedom of information. And yet states with big agriculture industries are passing these laws that make it a criminal offence to provide information to the public about the way their farmed animals are kept. So fortunately, we still have brave animal activists who get work in factory farms and have hidden cameras. So if you look online, you can see information about how the animals are kept. But the ag industry is doing its best to keep the information from the public. And surely that alone should let the public know that the ag industry understands that if the public saw how the animals whose flesh or eggs or milk they are consuming were actually kept, the public would rebel against this, would say, no, I don't want that. And quite possibly they would say, I'm not going to support that with my dollars, because that's what you're doing. If you purchase these products, you are supporting this industry. And I think everybody has a right to know exactly how their food is produced before they purchase it.
I just, it calls to mind, I think I remember this anecdote from your book about Kentucky Fried Chicken trying to showcase how well their birds are treated. And then the groups like came in after the video was made sometime later and saw completely different conditions.
That's right. Yes. In fact, the KFC or their lobbyists had actually paid, I think it was a TikTok influencer, to go into the farm, which had all been prettied up and, you know, density had gone down and the birds had been given some things like perches to swing on or something. And it all looked very good. And the influencer was completely fooled by this and said, oh, this is not too bad. You know, the birds have good lives. And then when the animal group went into the same shed at night, sometime later, all of those perches had gone. The birds were more crowded. There were sick and dying birds lying on the floor. As I said earlier, birds whose legs had collapsed under them, who couldn't really move around. It was a completely different story.
How did they respond to that? I mean, I know the influencer was just really appalled, but what about the facility?
I doubt that the facility changed. I think, yes, as you say, the influencer kind of apologized for being fooled, but, you know, whatever that facility did, those are standard conditions in the industry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a way, because the public is unaware of what's going on and they just walk into the supermarket and they buy what's cheap, mm-hmm. The producers have little choice. Right? Mm-hmm. If they don't produce that way, their product won't be bought.
Princeton University bioethics professor Peter Singer, new book, Animal Liberation Now. You can call in with a question, share what's on your mind, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Princeton University bioethics professor Peter Singer, who makes the case pain is pain and how animals feel pain is not so different from humans. His new book, Animal Liberation Now, is an update from his classic one in 1975 at the dawn of the animal rights movement. And please be aware of the nature of this discussion about animal suffering. You can call in with a question, share your perspective, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Lynn in Westby. Lynn, hi.
Good morning. I'd like to start by thanking Professor Singer for his work that has created an awareness as well as helping to develop a more compassionate society through his books and work. The question I have is, with so many organizations out there that are doing animal activism work, the Humane Society, PETA, the White Coat Project, Physicians for Ethical Treatment of Animals, World Wildlife Fund, how do you know which one to place your financial resources or to join and contribute volunteer efforts to?
Lynn, thank you. Peter.
Thank you. There are many around and there are many good organizations. You can go and look at a website called Animal Charity Evaluators, animalcharityevaluators.org, and they recommend a number of organizations. They're an independent organization, not part of any of the organizations themselves, but they assess and try to find the best organizations for you to donate to. And so they recommend many, I think, very effective organizations. I recommend that people do focus on organizations that are trying to do something for farmed animals, for factory farmed animals in particular, because both the numbers are larger than any other area. So far more animals, for example, than if you support shelters, which help stray dogs and cats, but they're relatively few compared to the number of farmed animals. And also, of course, the suffering of farmed animals is very prolonged. It's really lifelong for many of them, confined indoors, crowded all their lives in conditions that are completely unsuitable for their nature. So I recommend organizations that are working for that, and that does include People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. It includes the Humane League, which does good work on that, Mercy for Animals. There are a number of organizations that have a strong focus on trying to change the conditions of farmed animals.
Lynn, thank you for the call. One organization this spring, the Animal Liberation Front, claimed responsibility for freeing thousands of mink from a fur farm in Wisconsin. And animal rights activists doing this work often cite you as an inspiration. Are actions like freeing captive animals justified?
I don't believe that freeing mink is a good thing to do. Because mink are carnivores, they're predators. And if you free thousands of mink into the countryside, of course, they will want to eat, and they will try to catch and kill any animals who are around. And there probably aren't enough animals to support them. So if, you know, thousands of mink are suddenly released into the countryside, most of them will starve anyway. And those that don't starve will be killing other animals. So although I absolutely deplore mink farming, it's at terrible conditions for the mink. They're captive in small cages. They have nothing to do all day. And then, of course, they're killed for their fur. So I think nobody should be buying a mink or other furs for that matter either. But I don't think that freeing mink into the countryside is the way to stop this.
Peter, what should be the priorities of activists that would most benefit animals?
Well, I think we should try to get more people away from eating factory farm products, and preferably towards away from eating animal products at all. Those who are prepared to move to a plant-based diet, which is a better diet for the planet in terms of reducing your greenhouse gas emissions, reducing local pollution from animal manure, and also an excellent diet for your own health. But if people find that too difficult, then at least reduce your meat consumption, find products from farms that are organic and that allow animals to go outside. If possible, try to have a look at the farms yourself if you're able to travel to them, and limit yourself your animal consumption to those products. So I think that's really what we need to change the market conditions. And then eventually we will reduce and hopefully eliminate factory farming of animals.
Let's go to Pat now in Duluth, Minnesota. Pat, what's on your mind?
Hi. I just wanted to say that for people who eat meat, as your guest just said, the plant-based products that mimic chicken, beef, pork, people who eat meat will not know the difference in flavor with those plant-based products. And also, there are a lot of athletes, famous athletes, who are vegan, and they have said that they're...
Oh, Pat, I think we just lost you there. Peter, you've been a vegetarian since 1971. What has it meant for your life?
Yeah, I mean, it's been great for me. I've really felt good. I have plenty of energy. I'm 77 now. When I'm back in Australia where I'm from, I still go surfing. So I'm keeping pretty fit and well on that without eating meat. And basically now without eating animal products for the last few years. And there are plenty of others. I was at a place called Ethos Farm in New Jersey just a week or two ago, which is a farm that produces organic plant-based products. It's run by a doctor, Ron Weiss, who advocates that for health reasons. But Rich Roll was there with me. Rich Roll has a podcast. He's somebody who turned his life around when getting out of meat and animal products. He's a vegan. He's in his 50s now. He runs ultra marathons, and he's a great advocate for the fact that you can really be fit and healthy into long past the time when most athletes are still able to run and do things on a plant-based diet.
The Vegetarian Research Group reports vegetarian and vegan diets are much more common in the U.S. now than during previous decades. But as you note, since 1975, annual world meat consumption has jumped from 112 million tons to 300 million tons. Why are people eating more meat?
Well, a lot of this global increase is because of countries like China, where people have become more prosperous. And that's a good thing, obviously. We don't want people to be living in poverty. But when people in China get additional income, they do spend it on buying more meat. That's a prestigious product. It's something that they associate with being better off. So China is responsible for a lot of that increase, plus other Asian countries. India, although it has a strong vegetarian tradition, is also consuming more meat. They're two very large countries, and some other East Asian and Southeast Asian countries. So that's a large part of it. But even in the United States, meat consumption, mostly of chicken, has gone up. And I think that's perhaps because chicken has become inexpensive. But as I say, it's actually one of the cruelest animal products. Sometimes people say to me when I say I'm a vegetarian, they say, oh, well, I don't eat red meat. And not eating red meat is very good for the planet, because beef in particular is a major source of greenhouse gas emissions. But in terms of animal suffering, if you switch from beef to chicken, well, you're responsible for many more animals suffering, of course, because one chicken can only feed maybe three or four people, whereas a cow can feed many more. And of course, the chicken are all indoors all their lives, crowded 20,000, 30,000 birds in a single shed. So you are really responsible for more animal suffering if you switch from red meat to chicken.
Something I learned in your book that, you know, turkeys have like this equally atrocious life as chickens, and they remove parts of the turkey's body as it grows. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, well, turkeys are factory farmed in a very similar way to chickens. That is, they're crowded indoors in a huge shed. Because of the crowding and the stress, they may peck at each other. And turkeys have this piece of flesh called a snood, which is the red piece of flesh they have on their head. And that can be a target for pecking. So it does get removed without any anesthetic or anything like that. The other strange thing that most people don't know about the standard American turkey, it's an interesting thing to talk about if you are having it at Thanksgiving. These turkeys are bred to have huge breasts. Everybody knows that. People want the breast of the turkey. The breast is so big that turkeys cannot reproduce through sexual contact. The male of this breed simply cannot make that sexual contact with the female. So all of these factory farm turkeys are the result of artificial insemination. I wrote a book a few years ago called The Ethics of What We Eat with a co-author, Jim Mason. And to find out about this, he actually got a job working in a turkey insemination place. So his job was either to masturbate the male turkeys and collect the semen in a tube, or to grab the female turkeys, and then the semen was put into like a little gun thing that was propelled with air, and to squirt the semen into the female. And the females in particular hated this because, you know, it was done to them regularly, so they would have more fertile eggs, produce more turkeys, and they hated being grabbed and having this done to them. They struggled against it. But his job, under pressure to do it as quickly as possible, was to grab them and inseminate them.
Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University, Peter Singer, examining animal rights, cruelty to animals. Call in with the question. Still time to add your perspective along the way. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Princeton University bioethicist Peter Singer, author of Animal Liberation Now, making the moral case to change our attitudes toward animals and stop the cruelty inflicted through industrial farming practices and in research experiments. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. Peter, we heard from Nicole in Waukesha, called in to ask what you think about the practices of polyface farms in Virginia and the notion of their grass farming and their rotating of cows and pigs.
Well, polyface is one of the places that produces animal products without factory farming them, really. They do get to go out on grass, although I think some of the smaller animals like chickens are in cages, but they're much larger than, you know, the cages that egg-laying hens are usually in, and they do rotate. So, you know, I've debated with Joel Salatin, the head of Polyface Farms. I think he does care about animals and he does care about the environment, but he thinks that it's okay to eat them, that in some sense he thinks that's our right. I wouldn't eat his product, his animals myself. I don't think I need to. I don't see the point. And still the cows are certainly still producing greenhouse gas emissions despite the fact that they're on grass, and the animals are all killed in the end. But if you are committed to eating animal products, then a place like Polyface Farms is where you should get them from, in preference to just going to the supermarket and buying the cheap factory farm products where the welfare of the birds or the animals has been really, really bad. And they won't even let you know what the conditions are like. As we were saying earlier, you know, they will not allow people to see how they produce animals. Whereas Polyface Farms is open about the way they're producing animals, and that's something to their credit.
Let's bring in Linda in Milwaukee. Linda, hi. What would you like to ask? Hi.
I have a comment and a question. My comment is that for the past 20 years, I've informed myself about issues involving animal rights and animal welfare. But it wasn't until a couple of years ago that I found out about what are called animal killing contests. I know they go on across the country, and including here in Wisconsin, where they're advertised by bars and restaurants and such. I just think the idea of them is so appalling, and I don't know how many people really are aware that they do go on. So that's my comment about that. And then my question is, I've been vegetarian and vegan, and recently I started eating eggs again. And I wonder what, if anything, from an animal welfare or animal rights viewpoint, is wrong with eating eggs from, say, pasture-raised chickens or backyard chickens?
Linda, thank you. Peter, following up on that, go ahead.
Yes. Look, if you do feel you need to eat animal products, then I think eggs from pasture-raised chickens are probably about the best animal product that you can eat of those that you can get commercially. Do make sure that they genuinely are pasture-raised. Some eggs are labeled organic, for example, but they're not. The hens are not out on pasture ever. So if possible, you know, and look at the farm or call up the farm, say, can you come and have a look? That will help. Some people do object to them for two reasons. One is that the males of the egg-laying breeds of chickens, of course, don't produce eggs. So they get killed at birth. And some people will object to that. And the other factor is that the hens themselves will stop laying eggs at a fast enough rate for the commercial producers after a year or maybe 18 months, possibly 2 years. Whereas hens can live for 7 years quite easily. So they are being killed prematurely. So if you're concerned about the killing of animals, if you think that that's wrong in itself, then you would not do this. But if you think, well, as long as they have a reasonably decent life, that's a kind of compromise that I'm prepared to accept, then eggs from genuinely free-ranging, pasture-raised hens is probably the way to go.
Linda, thank you for the call. Chris from Galesville called in to ask, what is, quote, cruelty-free? Farming in general, including produce, is not cruelty-free for animals. What is that label?
Well, it can mean different things. There are different labels out there for cruelty-free or humanely produced. And as I say, you do really want to check the farm where your products have come from is the only way to be sure. And as I was just saying, you know, yes, it's all going to involve killing the animals, whether it's eggs, dairy or meat. Animals are going to be killed before the end of their natural lifespan. No question about that. But some of them, like the pasture-raised hens that I was just talking about, may have a reasonable life. People may keep hens in their backyard, for example, and then they may be assured if they have enough space that they have a good life or a reasonable life. So it's possible to have that, but it's certainly not the standard commercial way of producing animal products in the United States today.
Christine emailed to ask, what is the quality of life like for free-range chickens? What should Christine know?
Yeah, again, it's going to vary a lot from place to place, how crowded they are, how much freedom do they have to go outside. One thing that you could look at, for instance, is there grass where they go outside? You know, if you talk about pasture-raised, that suggests that there's grass on it. But if the stocking density is too high, too many birds per acre, the grass will all die. So, you know, if you can have a look at it and see if the birds are out on grass, then probably the stocking density is okay. If it's just a bare patch of dirt, it's not. And it's also not very interesting to the birds to go out. So they, you know, there's nothing for them there. So they will go out less. So try to find those things out from the place that is producing the eggs that you're getting. Or if it's free-range chicken, which is actually pretty rare, it's like, you know, 99.9, maybe even add another 9% of the birds of the chicken produced in the United States is from factory-farmed birds kept indoors in big sheds. But if you do get the tiny amount of free-range chickens raised for meat, then again, have a look at how densely stocked they are, what kind of lives they have. You can, you know, maybe you'll find that acceptable for you. It all depends on people have different standards. As I say, I think that the big thing is to avoid the factory farm products.
perhaps you've entered a restaurant where you smell, you know, maybe bacon or meat. Do you ever, this is personal, do you ever find yourself craving meat?
No, I do not. No. In fact, the smell of, you know, look, I admit I used to like bacon more than 50 years ago before I was a vegetarian. Now the smell of bacon frying, actually, it's very greasy. It's very high fat, I realize. And I, you know, my diet is much lower in fat for not eating animal products. And I don't even like that greasy smell anymore. I've got away from it.
And you've left us with recipes in your book as well. How have those recipes changed you?
Yeah, well, what I did this, you know, in the very first edition in 1975, I had a recipe section because there were very few vegetarians and there weren't very many vegetarian cookbooks. So I thought people need to know that.
You were filling a gap.
I was filling a gap, that's right. So I had these recipes. And then a lot of vegan and vegetarian cookbooks came out. So I thought, oh, I don't need this section. I dropped it. And lots of people wrote to me and said, oh, I love the recipes. It was great to have, you know, a book like yours that actually has recipes. So I put them back, but not the same ones. I put back more personal ones that my wife and I both like to cook. Some of them come from our sort of family traditions. My family came from Austria and her family came from Poland. So they're different cooking traditions. And you know, they're pretty heavily meat-based cuisines. But they do have some vegan dishes, so we put them in. Mm. I also really enjoy doing Asian cooking now, Sichuan cooking, stir fries with tofu and veggies and noodles or rice. I've put in a few of those kind of recipes as well.
Peter, thank you for joining us.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
It's been terrific talking to you, Kate. Thank you.
Peter Singer, bioethics professor, Princeton University, author of Animal Liberation Now. It is a revision of his animal rights book, first published in 1975. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.